which takes up an old story that I've been told many times. It's the film The Chariots of Fire, which I presume some of you have seen, that right? I presume nobody has seen, that right? Anybody seen Chariots of Fire? Well, there you go. Here's a free advertisement. Two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, ten, here. Here's a free advertisement for a film to go and see and take your friends. It's about a Christian and a Jew. And both of them are runners in the Olympic Games of the mid-1920s. The Christian was a great Christian man, and it's at least based on historical facts. How accurate it is to the fact is always more than questionable with films. But the great thing was his unwillingness to run in the Olympic Games when he found out that he had to run on a Sunday. He refused to do it, even though it was a very great chance he would win the gold medal in the event. He flatly refused to run on a Sunday. And many people tried to plead with him and encourage him to set aside his principles on the matter, but he declined and rather entered another race for which he was not as well suited, but which at least didn't run on a Sunday. As the story goes that I've been told, I've got no knowledge whether this is true or not, but I just went to youth fellowship meetings and I've told this story innumerable times. Someone actually gave him a piece of paper just before the final, and on this piece of paper was written a text of the Bible, but he didn't look at that until he had finished running the final. And in the final, I'll ruin the movie for you now, in the final he actually succeeds in winning a gold medal, even in an event for which he was not his particular race. And when opening the text that was written and given in his hand, which he carried in the final, it's a good story whether it's true or not, were the words, "The Lord honours those who honour him." Now, that is a story I've grown up with, and it's very interesting to see now that the filmmakers have seen it as a story that's worth putting on film. He later became a missionary in China, I understand. Did he do the right thing? Should he have run on the Sunday? Or was that a piece of Christian legalism that he was carrying on with? Would you run on Sunday? Should we play sport on Sunday? Organised sport. It was when the Australian Cricket Association, or whatever its full title is, I do not know, but when it changed its practices so that Sheffield Shield games were played on Sundays, that two of New South Wales' Sheffield Shield team quit first grade cricket. Not first grade, first class cricket. They refused to, they removed themselves from offering for Sheffield Shield cricket because they wouldn't play on a Sunday. Did they do the right thing? Does this mean no Christian can now ever play in that kind of grade of cricket? That it would be wrong for you to do it? It's a quaint saying that goes that Christians are the people who have turned the commandment, "You shall not work on Saturday," into "You shall not play on Sunday." And certainly the Lord's Day observance, which was a great theme of the 19th and early 20th century, led Christianity to a solemn and austere way of spending Sundays. It was not just there was no work to be done, there was no pleasure to be had either. The Sunday, the Christian Sunday, has only of very recent times passed here in Sydney. Very recent times. We may think in terms of the opening of pubs on Sundays, but that is only the last straw of a long list of straws that have been put forward. When I was at church at Manly some 10 years ago, I spoke with a man there who in his own lifetime, and he did this as an adult, he's now passed on, but he did it as an adult. There were a group of fellows playing a game of football on Manly Oval. And he and the rector went around and protested with them that they shouldn't be playing there on Manly Oval, and when they would pay no attention, they went to the local police, who went around to them and sent them off the oval because that was a wrong use of the Lord's Sabbath, the Lord's Day. Did he do the right thing? Is what he did any different to the Chariots of Fire man, or the cricketers in the Sheffield Shield? It's hard for us to imagine that you could get away with that, isn't it? Well, we couldn't imagine that people wouldn't be out playing on the... I mean, the grand final of the rugby league was played on Sunday, here in our very own parish. Not one member of the parish council asked me to go with them down to stop the grand final. Now, how do you account for this slip in Christian standards? What's right? What do we do on the Lord's Day?
Is the Lord's Day the Sabbath day? Is it the same thing? What are the rules and regulations that apply to it? Christianity's had this habit of creating a very somber Sabbatarianism. Fasting has been, not wrong in itself of course, but has been part of it. But although it's not very common in the Old Testament, indeed there's only one fast enjoined on the people of Israel, and it's hardly mentioned in the New Testament, yet through the centuries Christians have followed much more the Pharisaic tradition of having many fasts and seeing fasting as a good and proper thing. It's not particularly in the vogue amongst some of us here, although for some of us it is seen as somehow good. The observance of the seventh day and holding it as being different has also been something that Christians have fought for and continue to fight for, even though they seem to have been losing steadily in the last 30 or 40 years. Today, some people are very impressed by the ascetic, the man who gives up pleasures in a society and world that is so dominated by pleasure seeking. There is a certain degree of astonishment at people who are willing to become, for religious reasons only, vegetarians, who are willing to live in the counterculture, who are willing to deny themselves any form of physical pleasure by moving into monasteries or nunneries or communes or whatever that are built on the anti-pleasure principle. It's hard for our society to grasp hold of the possibility that anybody would do it. And so anybody who does is immediately seen as being very spiritual. What was Jesus' practice? Well, it wasn't like that at all. He didn't fast much. The only fast I think we have really recorded is the fast of the 40 days in the wilderness and temptation period. And he didn't teach fasting. He didn't enjoin fasting on his disciples. It wasn't part of his custom and practice. In fact, he was known as an eater and a drinker. You pick it up in the first verse of our passage tonight, Luke 5:33. They said, John's disciples often fast and pray, and so do the disciples of the Pharisees, but yours go on eating and drinking. You see it over in chapter 7, verse 33 and 34, where again the contrast is made with John the Baptist. John the Baptist came neither eating bread nor drinking wine, and you say he has a demon. The Son of Man came eating and drinking, and you say he is a glutton and a drunkard. Jesus was called a glutton. Jesus was called a drunkard. Because he was one unlike John the Baptist, who was all for feasting, all for going to the pubs, all for eating and drinking. Whereas John, like the Pharisees, were the men of the fast. Now Jesus' practice was not fasting, and his practice concerning the Sabbath was what consistently got him into trouble with his contemporaries. The thing that really irritated especially the Pharisees was that Jesus wouldn't observe the Sabbath practices and principles that they observed and that they thought were essential for godly living. And we see here tonight two of these events, two of the many that we know of. The eating of the grain on the Sabbath day that the disciples practiced in chapter 6 verses 1 to 5, and then the healing of a man on the Sabbath day in verses 6 to 11 of chapter 6. And this is the area in which fury and anger was aroused by Jesus' contemporaries. He was a very lax Sabbatarian. What is the defence that Jesus gives for the charges that are levelled against him concerning fasting and the Sabbath? There are three events here, and each has its own defence, and we'll look at those quickly. But what is more important is that in the defence that Jesus gives, we start to learn something of Jesus' understanding about life, which is far more important than just the defence to the particular charge that is levelled against him. Let's look at the defences first, though. The first one is the bridegroom. The question comes, why don't you fast like all the godly people, John the Baptist, disciples, the Pharisees? Why don't you fast like them? Why don't your disciples fast like them? And Jesus says, well, there's a time for fasting and there's a time for feasting. Fasting is a right thing in its time, but feasting is a right thing in its time. Now, when the bridegroom is around, well, that's not a time for fasting, isn't it? You don't go to a wedding reception and have a big fast, do you? A breakfast, but not a fast. That is the time for feast. If the bridegroom is present, it's feasting time. And the bridegroom is present. Now, in a little while, the bridegroom will be taken away. Then will be the time for fasting. But as long as the bridegroom is here, this is feasting time, my friends, not fasting time. John's time and my time are radically different times. John's time was fasting time. My time is feasting time. That's the first offence. It's a funny one, isn't it? The second one concerns not Daniel, as we have in our notes, but David. How my writing of David can look like Daniel, I couldn't believe till I had a look at it. My apologies to Michelle, it did look like Daniel, but it was David I meant. The disciples break the Pharisaic traditions, break the Pharisaic laws. They pick the grain, that's breaking the law. They rub it in their hands, that's breaking the law. They're working on the Sabbath. The Pharisees had a whole range of rules about the Sabbath, because when you have the law which says you shall not work on the seventh day, when you have that law, you've got a question, well, when is work work? I'm not knocking you, personally, because I've done exactly the same thing myself. But a lot of you do come and ask me if it's all right for you to be able to do this particular kind of work on the Sabbath, on the Lord's Day. Well, that, I mean, is it all right if you have Saturday night off and Sunday morning off, and is it all right if you don't actually work on any assignments that are due this year, but you start doing work for next year's work? Is it all right if you have lots of Sabbaths in first session and no Sabbaths towards the end of the year? Is it all right? There's all kinds of Pharisaic possibilities by which we can define when work is acceptable. Well, the Pharisees, who were trying to avoid work on the Sabbath, built up all kinds of little laws and little rules that put a safety device between them and starting to work. And whereas you would think walking along and just casually picking some grain off that would hardly qualify as work, yet within their rules and systems it qualified as work. And so they're working on the Sabbath, they're breaking the law. Jesus cites the case of David. David broke their traditions too. David and his followers were like Jesus and his followers. And David and his followers, when they were hungry, as Jesus' followers were hungry, they went into the temple and received the consecrated bread. There was special bread that was put out each week. And at the end of the week, at the Sabbath, it could be eaten. But it was directed that it was the priests who had the use of the bread. The law never said that no one else could have it. It just said that the priests could have it. David and his friends came and they were hungry, and the priest said, "We have no bread here except the consecrated bread." This is back in the book of Samuel, you'll find it. "We have no bread here except the consecrated bread." And David said, "Well, my men and I are hungry." And so the priest said, "Well, have you undergone ritual purity at this time?" And David said, "Yes, we have." And so the priest gave them the consecrated bread. Now that worried the Pharisees no end, because they had made the rule, though the scripture hadn't, that no one else was allowed to eat it but the priests. So here was David, the mighty king, the first Messiah in a sense, or the second Saul was the first. Here is the great Messiah David, and he is breaking the rules. Jesus says, "Well, I'm not doing anything different to that. My men and I." Now that's a little bit of a difficulty, and if you like having a little bit of a cat nap during sermons, this is a good time to have a cat nap. Well, I just spell out that presents you with a little difficulty in interpretation. I'll give you a whistle. Well, I won't give you a whistle, but I'll give you a yell when you need to come back in it. Because there's a side point here, just for a moment. You see, what is happening? Is it saying that David says that human need overrules cultic laws? That doesn't seem to me a right way of interpreting the Bible, because over and over again, you see, God actually enjoins his rules and laws upon people, and he punishes them for failure to keep it. Remember poor old Uzzah, the man who saw the Ark of the Covenant falling off the trolley one day, and he put his hand up to stop it, and he touched it. You're never allowed to touch the Ark of the Covenant, so he dropped dead on the spot. Well, you see, there was a need, wasn't it? And he fulfilled the need, and he was punished in a most severe and salutary fashion. Now, I don't think you can come at that method of interpretation. Well, some say, well, what Jesus is saying is that David, being the Messiah, and his men, they were not under the law, they were over the law. They could reinterpret the law, and so now I, the second David, the greater David, I can reinterpret the law. Well, that too is nowhere in Scripture that seems to me that David, in fact, is punished for his failure to keep the law of God. One of the characteristics of the Old Testament is that the people of God, even the king, were under the law. In some of the other ancient cultures, the king made the law and changed the law and wasn't under the law. But in Israel, the king was under the law. So that doesn't seem to me likely. Rather, I've gone for the third interpretation, that is, that what David broke was not the law, but the Pharisaic interpretation of the law, the pushing the law beyond what it says itself. For the law itself does not say that the bread was forbidden. It just says that it's for the priests to use it. Now, if the priests choose to give it to the king, that is the priest's prerogative, for it is theirs. I presume why it is picked up and used here as an illustration is because the only day of the week in which you could eat it was the Sabbath day. So here is another parallel, that the Pharisaic rules about eating when people are hungry on the Sabbath has a good parallel back with David. Now, it's a good time to wake up because we come to the third point, that is the doing good. For the third illustration is the man who actually has a right hand that is shriveled. Shriveled is a very hard word to say and read. Withered was much easier. And he used to be healed on the Sabbath. You'll notice the Pharisees and the teachers of the law were gathered around watching to see Jesus make a mistake. So Jesus gives defence. He poses a question to them. Which is right, to do good or to do evil on the Sabbath? Well, I mean, the answer to that's obvious enough, isn't it? What does the Pharisee want to do? He wants to do nothing on the Sabbath. He wants a third alternative. He doesn't want to do good, he doesn't want to do evil, he wants to do nothing that would break the law. His whole view of the Sabbath is negative. I do not want to do the wrong thing. There's no question of I do want to do the right thing, it's just a question of I do not want to do the wrong thing. Now the best way of not doing the wrong thing is do nothing. And so you let some poor man continue through life with a shriveled arm, but at least I didn't break the rule, did I? Jesus, in his very question, says, you either do good or you do bad. Which is it to be on the Sabbath? For clearly, healing the man is the good. And so he heals him and silences him at the same time. There are the three defences of Jesus. But do notice that their importance goes beyond just those particular events and incidents. For it shows Jesus' understanding. Jesus perceives himself to be the bridegroom at the feast. See, what makes it now the right time to be feasting instead of fasting? Because I'm here. That's why it's the right time. That is a fairly megalomaniac view, if you're less than God, isn't it? Okay, friends, you can enjoy yourself now. I've arrived. It is the kind of view that if someone said it, you think he's sending himself up. That's what he's saying. You can't fast while the bridegroom is here. Who do you think he means by the bridegroom? It's clearly himself, because that's what's different between he and the disciples of John the Baptist when the bridegroom wasn't there. His time is a time of joy and happiness, of feasting. His departure will be the time of fasting. When I am taken away, when the bridegroom is taken from them. Which is a funny way of talking about the bridegroom going on his honeymoon, isn't it? When he is taken from them. It's not talking about his honeymoon. It's actually pointing to his death when he is taken from them. That is the time to fast. But while he is here, this is the time for feasting. For in his arrival and his departure and his resurrection, Jesus is ushering in the new age. It's not an extension of the old age. It's the new age which is utterly incompatible with the old age. And so in verses 36, 37, you see the reference to the new wine in the old wineskins. The two things are incompatible. You put the new wine in the old wineskins and it'll burst the old wineskins. The two are incompatible as a new cloth and an old cloth. You don't rip up the new to patch an old. It's just incompatible. The two don't mix. It's one or it's the other. But it's not the two together. John the Baptist, the Pharisees, they represent the old age. The old age, which is the age of fasting, the old age in which the bridegroom hadn't arrived. But now I am here, the new age has come. When the bridegroom is here, now there are some people who will prefer the old age. Some people who are happy in the old solemnity of fasting. That may be the case. Verse 39, you see, no one after drinking old wine wants the new, for he says the old is better. You see, if you really are partakers of the old, you'll find the new quite unimaginable. Indeed, chapter 6, verse 11 indicates that is the case. For when they see Jesus do good on the Sabbath, they are furious and begin to discuss with one another what they might do to Jesus. The new age has come. And Jesus' consciousness of the new age is Jesus' consciousness of his own place as the bridegroom or as the Son of Man. Note verse 5 of chapter 6. Then Jesus said, the Son of Man is the Lord of the Sabbath. It is the new age because he is there. And who is he? The bridegroom, yes. The Son of Man. That is who he is. You may remember last week when we looked at chapter 5, we saw in verse 24 of chapter 5, that the Son of Man has authority to forgive sins. Now, the Son of Man in chapter 6 verse 5, we are told, is the Lord, is the master and ruler and owner of the Sabbath. That's a strange phrase, isn't it? Who and what is this Son of Man? I think I suggested to you last week that the phrase itself could mean oneself. It can be just a way of talking about yourself in the indirect speech. Or it could be emphasizing your humanity. And so it's a way of saying, man is the Lord of the Sabbath. Or it could be pointing back to Daniel chapter 7, where we find that one who is like the Son of Man will in the judgment day, in the last great age, will be given the authority to rule over all kingdoms and all peoples forever and everywhere. That is, Daniel 7's vision of the final age is the vision of the Son of Man who is the Lord of everything. The New International Version translation is, it seems to me, right, therefore, to give the phrase the Son of Man capital letters there, because it points back that he's not just saying man is the Lord of the Sabbath. He's not just saying I am the Lord of the Sabbath. He is saying that Daniel 7, that Son of Man, that one is the Lord of the Sabbath. And of course, in saying it, he is saying it of himself. For we know, we readers of Luke's Gospel, we know that's who he is, because we've been told that already. And Luke knows it, because he's written giving us the message. And Jesus knew it. But his contemporaries are rattling and trying to understand it. We're reading a book, an account of something that we know more than the people who are involved in the action. And so when Jesus says to them, the Son of Man has authority to forgive sins, when Jesus says to them, the Son of Man is the Lord of the Sabbath, they will be standing there saying, what's he saying? He runs the Sabbath? Or the Sabbath is for man? Or is he talking about Daniel 7? And is he saying he's that? They've got questions because they don't know the answers to those things yet. But we know that's what he is meaning. That he is the Lord of the Sabbath. The Son of Man, the bridegroom, brings the new age of the Sabbath. What is this Sabbath? It is the age of God's rest, where we do good, not evil. It is as old as creation, and it is far away as the final age. For when we come to heaven, what will we find? We will find the rest of God. That's what we will find. We will find the Sabbath. We will find the seventh day that God created in the beginning. We will find God's good weekend. For God is the creator of the good weekend. He created the world in 6 days, and then the seventh day was his day. And he declared it to be good, very good. It's God's day. Now, we have well and truly fallen away from that in our sinfulness. But that is God's good day, which is a picture of heaven. You remember the Old Testament lesson in Isaiah chapter 65 we had read for us. It's a picture of the final state where everything is working properly again, isn't it? Where if you don't make it to 100, it's because you're actually accursed. I mean, we'll all get to 100 in good health to boot. Be no babies dying and things like that. And the ox and the lion, they'll be eating straw together and peace and harmony. And that's the picture of heaven, the picture of the Sabbath. That is what Jesus brings in. So in this little section we have before us, we actually get aroused a whole set of Christian understanding. Which Sabbath is he speaking of? For we start to see that there are several different aspects of a Sabbath. Indeed, one of the commentators I have says that there are several different Sabbaths in the Bible. He says there are 4 Sabbaths in the Bible. I number them differently to the way he does, but let me rattle them out for you because it helps tease them out. I'm not sure that we should say there are 4 different Sabbaths because there really is only one of which there are 4 different aspects. And one of our problems lies in the fact that we keep confusing them all together when the Bible actually holds them apart. One is the day of creation. The seventh day. God's day. When all is very good. And that actually builds into life the rhythm of 6 days work and 1 day rest. That is the way God works. And that is the way in which he's created order. That you and I, as the workers in it, are to work. So in Exodus chapter 20, when we get the Ten Commandments, we're told to remember the Sabbath day. See, the Sabbath day is not created in Exodus chapter 20. It's been there since creation. What we're to do is to remember it. And we're to remember it to keep it holy. And we're told to remember it there. Why? Because in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea and all that in them is, and rested the seventh day. And therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. The seventh day is the day of creation. And the people of Israel are called upon to remember that day because that is the way the world is made. That is the way we're to live. 6 days work, 1 day rest. There is the first Sabbath. You find it referred to again in Hebrews chapter 4. And could I ask you to keep your finger in Luke 5 and turn to Hebrews chapter 4, because there's quite a few references to Sabbath there in Hebrews 4. Hebrews 4 and verse 4. For somewhere he has spoken about the seventh day, somewhere, that's good. The man who wrote Hebrews wasn't very good on remembering his text of his Bible. He obviously hadn't been taught how to memorize the scriptures properly. For somewhere he has spoken about the seventh day in these words, and on the seventh day God rested from all his work. Even I knew vaguely where that one was. You see, God's rest is right back there. The Sabbath day is right back there in creation. That's the first aspect of the Sabbath. The second is the other end of the spectrum. It is indicative of the final rest of God. But Sabbath is a way of talking about heaven. It's talking about the end of the world and the new age in which we can live in perfect fellowship and harmony with God. We can live as we were created to live back in Genesis. That's why they're not really two different Sabbaths. They're just two aspects of the same Sabbath. You see it in verse 5 of Hebrews 4. And again in the passage above, that's Psalm 95 that's been quoted in verse 3, and again in the passage above he says, they shall never enter my rest. It still remains that some will enter that rest. And those who formerly had the gospel preached to them did not go in because of their disobedience. The author in this passage, and you'll need to study it yourselves later, the author of this passage indicates that the promised land was the rest of God, was the Sabbath rest. The Sabbath was the promised land. And he talks about the fact that the people of Israel wandered around the wilderness heading towards the rest of God, but they didn't make it. They all died out in the wilderness. But it wasn't the promised land, he says. Because when the psalm about it was written, they'd been living in the promised land for a couple of hundred years. So what was the psalm about? It wasn't about the promised land. It was about heaven itself. The rest of God is heaven. So look down to verse 9. There remains then, or verse 8, for if Joshua had given them rest, God would not have spoken later about another day. There remains then a Sabbath rest for the people of God. For anyone who enters God's rest also rests from his own work, just as God did from his. Let us therefore make every effort to enter that rest, so that no one will fall by following their example of disobedience. That is, the Sabbath that God created in the first place, the seventh day of creation, is indicative of his final state, when we will be in the rest of God forever. And so the picture of heaven that you get in the book of Revelation is that we all rest from our labours. There is the second aspect then, heaven. First is creation, second is heaven. The third aspect is the Jewish Sabbath. We see it back in Exodus 20, that they were called upon to remember the creation Sabbath. That is because the Jewish Sabbath is not a different Sabbath. It's still part of the Sabbath thing, but it's a different aspect. Because they remember the Sabbath of creation, but they also are to observe the seventh day because God has rescued them from Israel, from Egypt rather. Let me read to you the Ten Commandments again, this time from Deuteronomy. You find it in Deuteronomy chapter 5. The Ten Commandments you find twice in the Old Testament, once in Exodus 20, once in Deuteronomy 5. And they are the same commandments, and everything is the same except the commandment about the Sabbath. I'll read it for you. If you don't believe me, turn it up. But if you do believe me, just listen, you'll be able to follow it. I still hear people turning me up. Good on you, you mustn't believe what I say. That's Deuteronomy 5:12. Observe the Sabbath day by keeping it holy as the Lord your God has commanded you. 6 days you shall labour and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, neither you or your son, your daughter, your manservant, your maidservant, your ox, your donkey, or any of your animals, nor the alien that is within your gates, so that your manservant and maidservant may rest as you do. Remember that you were slaves in Egypt, and that the Lord your God brought you out of there with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. Therefore the Lord your God has commanded you to observe the Sabbath day. You see, the reason for Sabbath day observance in Deuteronomy's Ten Commandments is not creation, but is the rescue from Egypt. That's a different reason, this Sabbath. And the Jewish Sabbath actually has a different effect. So in Exodus chapter 31, Exodus chapter 31 and verse 13, we read, "You must observe my Sabbaths. This will be a sign between me and you for the generations to come, so that you may know that I am the Lord who makes you holy." The reason the people of Israel are to observe the Sabbaths is to show that they are the covenant people of God, that they are God's chosen people. So the Jewish Sabbath observance has to do with being Jewish. It is a sign of being Israelite. It's a sign of being God's chosen nation. That is why the Jews have to observe the Sabbath. It's a sign of being different. And it worked too, because in the ancient world, they had a day off on a day which no one else had off. It was a great problem to the rest of them. It's very difficult to live with people who keep on going on holidays on days when no one else is going on holidays. It always marks them out as being different, that they take off the wrong day of the week. And we who have lived in a two-day weekend, indeed a three-day weekend whenever possible, we don't grapple with how difficult it must be to live in other countries where everybody has Friday off. It's hard, you see. Sunday is the normal work day, and it's not easy to be able to just go along to church on Sunday anymore. What should we do? Start having church on Friday? Or stop working on Sundays and lose our jobs? The Jews took the latter line. They said, well, we won't work on a Saturday and lose our jobs. But we will not work on Saturday because we are the Lord's people. And the Lord rescued us out of slavery, therefore we will not even get our slaves work on the Lord's day. So it was a Jewish Sabbath. Not different to creation. It's still the principle of one day and seven, rest, etc., etc. But specifically tied into the seventh day and specifically tied into being Jewish. Now there is a fourth aspect of the Sabbath day, the final one. That is, and this is the one we see here in Luke chapter 6. With the arrival of Jesus, we come into the second Sabbath day. The second one that I mentioned. That is heaven. That is God's eternal rest. That is the new age. When Jesus arrives, the new age is ushered into this world. That's what he's on about. And you say, well, look, if that's heaven, I missed it, because I still think I'm in earth. But that's what Jesus is on about. That the kingdom of heaven has come to earth now. And if you come into relationship with God through Jesus now, you are already entering into heaven. Well, does that mean that when I die, it'll be just like this? No, no, it will be better than this. But it won't be fundamentally different to this. For heaven will be fundamentally being in relationship with God and God's people. And those who are in Christ Jesus are in relationship with God and God's people. And we will rest from our labours, for we will be fellowshipping with him for eternity. But that's something we experience in the here and now. The reason one of the reasons we know that we will go to heaven when we die is because we know we're in heaven already. That's one of the reasons. You see, we know you're already in relationship with God through Jesus Christ. And that continues on through death. Death will not interrupt that. Nothing can separate us from the love of God that is in Christ Jesus. There's no way we can be cut off from that or from God's people. And so we are already in the rest of God now. But once you say that, then which day of the week are you in heaven? Every day of the week you are in heaven. And so all days become the same. Every day is as good as any other day. I don't get there once a week. I get there every day. I'm permanently in the hands of God. And that's why Jesus is saying that when you're here now with the bridegroom, this is the time of the feasting. The great messianic banquet has arrived with me. Take me away. That's the time for fasting. But while I am here, that is the time for feasting. And I am with you even to the end of the age, he promises his disciples later. So, if you go to Romans chapter 14 with me, you'll see that this is not a point at which we should fight and squabble amongst ourselves. But it's clear what Paul's understanding is that comes from Jesus. Romans chapter 14, verse 5. Romans 14, verse 5. One man considers one day more sacred than another. Another man considers every day alike. Each one should be fully convinced in his own mind. He who regards one day as special does so to the Lord. He who eats meat eats to the Lord, for he gives thanks to God, and he who abstains, and so it goes on. In the discussion of Christian liberty, of vegetarianism, another illustration of Christian liberty is our attitude towards special days. Some people wish to regard some days as special. Paul says, well, if you want to do that, good. But you do it yourself, and don't put it on anybody else. And if you regard every day as the same, well, that's good. Don't stop the man who wants to have a special day. If he wants to have a Christmas day or an Easter day, well, that's his privilege. There's nothing wrong in having an Easter day. There's nothing particularly Christian in having an Easter day either. For every day is an Easter day, isn't it? Jesus doesn't rise once a year. He is risen and is alive forevermore. Every day I can sing, Jesus Christ is risen today. Every day I can sing that, can't I? There's nothing wrong with singing it on Easter day. And if I want to hold an Easter day, that's all right, but that's not an area in which Christians are hung up of anymore. Days of the year, it's like the food you eat, it's an irrelevance. Unless, of course, someone starts to make rules about it, then you need to resist them. So in Colossians chapter 2 and verse 16, therefore, do not let anyone judge you by what you eat or drink or with regard to a religious festival, a new moon, celebrations or a Sabbath day. These are a shadow of the things which are to come. The reality is found in Christ. You see, the old Jewish Sabbath, when you downed tools for a day and you got together with your God's people and kept the day holy, that was a little foretaste of heaven. That was a little indication of what is to come. That was a shadow of the reality that lay ahead. That was an appetizer for the banquet. But we believe the banquet has arrived. We believe the heaven has arrived. We believe the reality is now. We believe that Christ is the one. And therefore, to run back to having it once every 7 days is to some extent to miss the point. And to actually have someone ruling over you and saying what you must and must not do on the Sabbath day is to put yourself back under the law. And you mustn't allow that to take place. So don't let anyone rule over you even on the Sabbath question. For you, every day is the Sabbath day. That's just a shadow of the reality that comes. And so again, in Galatians, Paul writes, and I'll just read it to you, in Galatians 4:10, he complains about them. He says, you're observing special days and months and seasons and years. I fear for you that somehow I've wasted my efforts on you. To go back to the observance of the rules and regulations of Sabbatarianism is to fall, to some extent, away from a right understanding of the gospel. So which Sabbath are we talking of? That is the question we need to ask when we're trying to work out what we are doing. You will see, of course, that people who don't make that distinction and that understanding of Sabbath, such as, for example, the Seventh-day Adventist movement, gets themselves in terrible tangles in putting themselves under the law when they claim it to be in Christ. Which day then? Well, our Sabbath is every day, if we're in Christ Jesus. Today and tomorrow. There is no special day. Every day is the Lord's day, every day is the Sabbath day. Well then, does that mean I now work 7 days a week? No, not at all. Well, you shouldn't. Because the way the world has been created is to work on the rhythm of 6 days labour and 1 day's rest. You break that pattern of labour and rest, and you ruin yourself. It's like the person who never does any exercise. I mean, it's like the person who never sleeps at night. I mean, we're created as people who need rest and need work, who need exercise and who need sleep. And working 6 days, resting one, is just part and parcel of creation. And the person you will hurt the most, ultimately, when you work 7 days a week, is yourself. You destroy yourself. You're not created to run like that. Now, there are people who own motor cars, and they run them contrary to the manufacturer's directions. I was with somebody who's actually in church with us here tonight, and we ran my motor car from Lake Macquarie down to Sydney without water in the radiator. It was an interesting exercise. You can do it. We made it. We did arrive that night out at Cabramatta, in fact, where the car finally finished up. which is where we wanted it to go, basically. Although I had hoped it would come back from there, but it couldn't quite. You can run your life on 7 days' work each week, you can do that, but that is not the way you've been built to run. You're built to work and rest and keep the two separate. But that is not the Sabbath day of the final... nor is it the Exodus 20 Sabbath day, really, or the Deuteronomy 5 one, especially. That kind of Jewish Sabbath, that we're no longer under. We're free of that, for we have the reality of every day. Well, what do you do then in the Sabbath? Well, if you're talking about the creation day, what you do is you rest, you stop working. It can be any day of the week. You can have your Sabbath on Wednesday if you like. I mean, you know, it's hard for clergymen to get upset about people saying you must have your Sabbath on Sunday, because I actually work on Sundays. I've got to have my Sabbath on another day of the week. Most clergymen have it on Monday. I don't know, I have it on Saturday. Well, that doesn't make me more righteous than the ones who have it on Monday. Working and resting is just something you need to do. It's a good and right and proper thing to do. And which day you do it on doesn't matter, provided you do it once a week. And what do you do on it? Well, you rest. What do you find restful? What do you find that's not working? Do that which is restful. Well, then, does that mean that Christians shouldn't have a special day? Well, in terms of law and right and wrong, no. No, there's no real reason. But in terms of convenience for fellowship, yeah, of course, there's a tremendous advantage, isn't there? I mean, if we all had a different day of the week off, it'd be pretty hard to get together for Christian fellowship. The advantage of everybody in a community having the same day off is that you can get together for Christian fellowship. That's a marvellous advantage. It's a great thing. It's a way of using a rest day quite profitably and usefully. And so there's tremendous advantage in us having a particular day set aside. But if you were living in a country in which everybody took Thursday off, well, it seems to me that's the day you go to church. Everyone should go to church on a Thursday then. Because that's obviously the day when it'll be easiest for people to get to church, to get into fellowship with each other. For every day is as good as any other day. But what should I do every day that is Sabbath? Do I stop working? No. But I enjoy life. That's fun to do. I'm to serve the Lord and to serve man. I'm to do the good things that God has prepared beforehand for me to work on. Because the Sabbath, as Jesus rightly points out in Luke 6 here, is to do good. That's the day. That's what you're supposed to do on the Sabbath day. You rejoice in the Lord, in his world, and in the privilege of doing that which is right. For that is what heaven is about. Rejoicing in the Lord and his people, doing that which is good that God has created us to do. That is, God wants us to have a good weekend every day of the week. That's what he wants us to have. Good weekend all the time. To live a life of enjoyment. For the bridegroom is with us now. And so we should rejoice in the Lord.